And I wonder whether any text in the Bible could be more relevant to our contemporary Western society and church. We seem to have these days a desperate desire for a new global society, don't we? We even have churches, multi-faith groups, aiming to achieve unity at all costs, even at the expense of the truth.
Welcome to The God-Centered Life with Josh Moody. The series is called God-Centered Life. Today we're looking at the Tower of Babel from Genesis chapter 11, verses 1 through 9. Josh Moody is senior pastor of College Church located in Wheaton, Illinois. Thanks for joining us today. Josh, a bit of a light bulb moment there. Easy to draw a line between the push for unity at all cost and the topic of today's passage, the Tower of Babel. It feels like you're saying that we're not that different from them.
Yeah, exactly. The human condition is the same. We long for unity and peace and community, but we're still rebels, and so we try to achieve it without God. And the result of that is disaster. And so the story tells that disaster and points us to the place of true unity, which is around what Francis Schaeffer would call the true truth.
And I would cue you up, though, to be prepared for a bit of a surprise as to the tone of this disaster. There's some interesting things that we'll take a look at during this study. Let's get to it. Genesis chapter 11. Here's Josh.
Well, friends, brothers and sisters, if you would turn with me once more to the book of Genesis. A squat gray building of 34 stories. Over the main entrance, the words, Central London Hatchery and Conditioning Center. And in a shield, the world state's motto, community, identity, stability. So begins Aldous Huxley's seminal novel, A Brave New World. It's heavily ironic in tone, as if you've read it, you will notice, and I'm sure we've seen various versions of it down through the years and heard commentators about it. It's heavily ironic, A Brave New World. And it depicts a kind of utopian fantasy, but one which is actually, ironically, horrific. Unlike its twin, the also pretty well-known George Orwell's 1984, A Brave New World fears the totalitarian control of a state, not by force, as it is in George Orwell's vision, but instead by technological innovation and acquiescence to a dumbed-down society. Many then feel that of those two visions, 1984 and A Brave New World, the one which Huxley gave birth to, his vision of the future, is of the two more likely to come true. After the Animal Farm vagaries of the Soviet era predicted in 1984 fell apart. As another more recent futurist put it, someone who tries to predict the future, another more recent futurist put it, we are amusing ourselves to death. We have increasingly complex and addictive gadgets. Our consumerist society is fueled by an industrial entertainment complex that is constantly seeking more ways to tell us that we need the latest must-have applications, even billed that way in sort of marketing training seminars, a must-have application, must-have. This or that, not just fashion, but this or that gadget is so last year. In A Brave New World, of course, they munch on the drug which is called soma in order to escape the boredom of life and sort of escalate to a more exciting experience. They munch on soma as a drug to escape. Well, I guess some social commentators might be saying, well, we just plug into the latest iPod. You see, it's tempting to read this well-known story about the Tower of Babel and consign it to irrelevance, or if not at least oddity. I don't know what you felt when we had it read out and when we reflected on it a little bit early in the service as well. When I first read this, again, as I was beginning this week to study it through, as I looked at it again in preparation for this morning, I immediately thought of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and the Babel fish. Anyone a fan of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? I feel a few nods, right? Yes, that's right. It didn't do very well in the movies, but apparently it's doing well on DVD, which is good news, you know, so. And the Babel fish, if you don't know it, is one of those sort of strange ideas that Douglas Adams came up with, whereby you kind of put this fish in your ear and immediately translate it into all the languages of the universe, you know. I think of something sort of strange and sort of fanciful like that. Or I think of those medieval paintings that seem to emphasize that God is somehow against urbanization, you know. He's against really tall buildings, sort of thing, you know. And sort of spoils everyone's fun, you know, architects watch out, you know, or whatever. But instead, you see, Babel stands for human unity rebelliously formed and organized against God. You see, in the account of Genesis so far, we have seen, you've picked up, how God created everything good originally, and that was made bad in Genesis chapter 3 by man's rebellion against him. That's been the story so far, and it explains our reality, where we're at in life. And we've read, after Genesis chapter 3, of the downward spiral away from God with Cain, if you remember, with the men after that of the name who misuse their religious status abusively to sort of disempower others and exercise kind of authority over people in a wrong kind of way. And we have seen God's promised redemption to come through the birth of the child who would crush the serpent's head, the serpent crusher, promised even in that chapter 3. We've seen how God graced Noah in the midst of his judgment of the world. God has a salvation plan that he's bringing to bear and that is available for all. But now, right before God sort of picks out Abraham, who will become the father of all the faithful, he picks right before in chapter 12, God picks out Abraham, through whom he will bless all nations. The people of this world in chapter 11 take a further step in their rebellion. No longer, it seems, satisfied with personal or individual rebellion against God. They kind of clubbed together to form a society that would organize for their relief and prosperity a city, even with a religious tower to the heavens, but one which was for them and against the Creator God and against his good rule. It was a brave new world. And I wonder whether any text in the Bible could be more relevant to our contemporary Western society and church. We seem to have these days a desperate desire for a new global society, don't we? We have the brave, very well-intentioned trumpeting of the United Nations, that secular organization. You know, we the peoples of the UN determined to unite our strengths to achieve international peace and security, blah, 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 etc., 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 right? We even have churches, multi-faith groups, aiming to achieve unity at all costs, even at the expense of the truth about God and salvation. And you see, Babel tells us that not all unity is good unity. And that's very challenging, isn't it, for our way of looking at life today? That not all community is righteous. That God will not stand idly by while we form a wicked gang to terrorize the neighborhood. But will and has intervened. The difference, you see, is this. Man builds up, but God comes down. And that's the difference between the city of Babel and the city of God.
Breaking down the human buildup in just a moment. But first, a reminder that Josh Moody is senior pastor of College Church. You're listening to the preaching ministry of Josh, and it's called God-Centered Life. We thank you for joining us, and we hope that however you're finding us, you would let others know that this resource is available, whether it's a podcast, radio, or directly from our website, godcenteredlife.org. Back into Genesis 11, here's Josh.
First then, what we have here explained for us is the kind of, very helpfully, the vanity of human inventiveness, which is lacking, though, spiritual revelation. You see, what happens is we build ourselves up vainly, but only really God can create. In other words, we make kind of human-centered programs, our own initiative, when instead we should be making God-centered disciples. My passage in my quiet time this morning was very striking for me about this. And he, that is Jesus, died for all, that those who live should no longer live for themselves, should no longer live for themselves, but for him who died for them and was raised again. And we're so much not like that, aren't we? We want to create a program for ourselves, even with a religious gloss of one kind or another. You see here, in this passage in front of us in chapter 11, there's a lot of sparkling symbolism that shines this truth of the priority of the necessity of spiritual revelation through the Word, and really understanding and seeing it and getting it. They, as you see, were symbolically moving, it says, in the east or eastward. Well, of course, if you've been attuned to these things that were going on, it was on the east side of paradise where man and woman were originally ejected. And then it was east of Eden that Cain went in exile. And now it is to the east that humanity kind of symbolically clubs together creatively to form a gang against the Creator. They urge each other on in rhythmic, another kind of symbolism here that's underlining in the translation. They urge each other on in rhythmic, chain gang-like song. Literally, there's, let us brick bricks, let us burn them to a burning. You can almost hear them singing to us, let's brick bricks, let's burn them to a burning. And it's a rhythmic, chain gang-like kind of song. You can almost hear them singing in unison as they do it. And together with their sort of joint might, of course unity can be a powerful thing, together with their joint might, they push through the circumstantial difficulties that have decided less determined rebels. The plane has no stones, we may assume. So, well, no matter, they make bricks and use the tar of the oil bubbling out through that region of Babylon. They find a way together to do it. Of course, they're motivated very strongly by human ambition to make a name for ourselves when their purpose was meant to be to honor God's name. Again, another symbolic point that's picked out there. They were motivated by human fear not to be scattered over the face of the earth when God, of course, had graciously intended to disperse the peoples, to go out into the whole world and enjoy it, multiply and enjoy all that is there, but they clubbed together for fear. I don't know whether you like the cartoons of Calvin and Hobbes. I really like them. I've got a book at home, a collection of them. They're wonderful. I don't even remember this one. One of them, Calvin, is doing a show and tell at school. And he has a kind of plastic container in front of him, you see. And he says something like this. You know, he puts these very sophisticated words into Calvin every now and then, who's a five-year-old. You can never imagine a five-year-old really speaking about that. It's very funny, though, isn't it? He says something like this. In this container, there's one of the miracles of the world, unique in its individuality, utterly beautiful in its microscopic arrangements, inspiring poetic flights of fancy all over the world, or something like that, right? I have brought for you, for show and tell today, a snowflake. And there's a pause, although it moves on to the next kind of cartoon box, you see. And Calvin says, or at least I had, but having brought it into this classroom, it's become nothing but a pool of water. And while I wait for the imagery of what happens to the individual once they enter the system of the school to sink in, I'm going to go outside the door, you know. The rather walrus-like teacher says, Calvin! You know. Or someone else has remarked, when God freezes water, he makes a snowflake. When man freezes water, what does he make? Ice cubes. And so here in this brave new world, they're busy making ice cubes, turning snowflakes into water. You know, it may be that the tower was one of the ancient ziggurats whose ruins still dot the landscape of modern Iraq. Herodotus, the ancient historian, describes how, in his time, visitors to such ziggurats could make use of the conveniently placed chairs on the way up the very lengthy staircase as they went out at the tower. They were kind of religious tourist traps, a kind of religious version of the Guggenheim. You know, here's a nice chair, I can sit as I go up. You know, except, oh. Religious tourist traps. The religious nature of this tower here is clear. They wanted a tower that reaches to the heavens, or whose head is in the heavens, not just the sky, but the abode of God symbolically, or perhaps even literally for these now almost pagan peoples, I suppose. They were trying to make a stairway to heaven. God had intended the people to scatter for their good, to go forth and multiply and fill the earth and take possession of it. But they mistook this as a threat and sought to create a false religious unity. You see, sin is always like this, with a religious gloss or not. It always begins with unbelief in the goodness of God's rule. Saw that right at the beginning. Did God really say? Surely that fruit looks good. I should just take it. God just wants to spoil our fun. Pleasant. God's rule can't be good. Those commands, thou shalt not steal, spoil sport. God, why not? Why can't I get ahead and make a buck or two on the side? Thou shalt not commit adultery. Oh God, you don't know what it's like to be a man. Why can't I have a few on the side? Thou shalt not make for thyself an idol. Oh, come on, God, we just love that kind of stuff. Aren't there lots and lots of different ways to heaven? Spoil sport, God. And as such, we sacrifice contentment in our constant search to be richer and richer. We sacrifice security and commitment in our ability to stay together in our marriages. And we sacrifice communion or intimacy with the Holy of Holies, the one God of all, the Creator. God, through whom we may have access through Jesus by faith. And so what happens, of course, is that God's authority is taken by these guys, and so often by us too, isn't that true, friends? For dictatorship, not the blessing he intends. I don't know whether you've noticed that word blessing is much misused, a much misused expression these days. Whenever I hear blessing, I think of those charged words of 70s rocker Keith Green. He's long dead now. He was one of these 70s rockers with flares and, you know, the whole thing. He sung once like this. It's a song called Asleep in the Light. Bless me, Lord. Bless me, Lord. It's all I ever hear. No one aches, no one hurts, no one even sheds one tear, but he cries, he weeps, he bleeds, and he cares for your needs, and you just lay back and keep soaking it in. Oh, can't you see it's such a sin? Because he brings people to your door, and you turn away as you smile and say, God bless you! Be at peace, and all heaven just weeps, because Jesus came to your door, and you left him out on the streets. I don't know about you, but I'm sick and tired of hearing religious charlatans tout prosperity as the way to get someone to get into Jesus. Laughter? Jesus was called Man of Sorrows, but he was very spiritual, don't you think? Money? Jesus had nowhere to lay his head. Didn't he have enough faith? Where was his BMW? Blessing? Jesus said, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now there is joy, let me not hide it from you. Oh yes, there is blessing, oh yes. But as Jesus said, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul? We have joy in the journey. We have joy in Christ. We don't have joy by just baptizing consumerist materialism according to Christianity. And so you see, friends, when you see or hear those reports of thousands of folk gathered around the latest prosperity gospel, think of the ziggurat, the tower, and wonder when God will come down and confuse their language, for it will happen. Seek me and live, the Bible says. Not seek money and get God thrown in as a 2-for-1 blue light special. To avoid wasting our lives with vain human activity, we need accept God's revelation in His Word. We need not build up a program for ourselves. We need, I don't know, have a dinner party for a few friends and invite a staff member to give a brief gospel talk or something from the Word that has been revealed about Christ. We need to meet with a few friends over lunch to read a book, like when people are big and God is small together, to get a bigger vision for who God is. We make sure our faith is God-centered by being orientated by the revelation of His Word. But not only do we need practically to commit to the Bible, that's not the only application here, though it is an important one, the revelation that they missed that we need to hold on to. Not only do we need practically to commit to the Bible, we also need to see what it says specifically about, second, the sovereignty of God over the affairs of all the nations. And in a sense, you see, what's going on here is that we build ourselves up, but only God can provide for the nations, for all our communities. And you see, part of the message here is that God is providentially in charge of the nations. Right before this chapter, you have a Bible, you'll see, I mean, it's not a surprise, before chapter 11 comes chapter 10, you know. And right before this chapter, in chapter 10, we have had the Table of Nations, as it's been called for a long, long time, since time immemorial. And what it's saying there in this Table of Nations is that God is in charge of the nations. And in fact, it may be that the people who settled here in Shinar, that is in Babylon, were Hamites from Nimrod, who established, chapter 10 tells us in verse 10, who established the center of his empire in Shinar. We don't know for sure, but whoever they were, they are part of the nations of the world building their empire. And what they needed to realize is that God is sovereign over the affairs of the nations. As Proverbs says, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. Now, they needed this lesson, don't you think? They thought that their tower reached the heavens. But in fact, God had to come down just to see it, didn't he? Where is it in that, you know? Now, the writer isn't displaying his sort of unsophisticated anthropomorphism. He's not saying he thinks God lives physically in the sky and had to descend spatially. No, he's, by this figure of speech of God coming down, he's emphasizing how puny are their works on a divine scale. As it were, the atomic bomb, impressive. God can make bigger bangs than that, you know. The size of any military machine, well, impressive, well, that pales beside the one who is captain of the Lord's army. They were building up to the heavens, so they thought, well, God had to come down to be able to see what they were doing at all. Is that it down there? I can't quite see it, you know. They thought that because of their unity of speech, there was no stopping them, but God confused their speech in a divine act of sovereignty over the nations. They thought they could do it together. Come on, they say, verse 3, let us. It's a very kind of idiomatic phrase, go to, literally. Come on, they say, let us. Go on, let's go. Verse 3, come on, again, exactly the same, they say, verse 4, let us. Come on. God says, verse 7, let us go down. God put a stop to their collaborative rebellion. God's sovereignty is not limited by the might of human nations.
That's Josh Moody, and this is the God-Centered Life. Josh, towards the end of the study there, you talk about the sovereignty of God over the nations. Definitely in play there during that period of time, but relevant today as well, right?
The Lord is sovereign over the political waves of every nation, over the empires and the kingdoms and the countries. And we who are in Christ have a king of a kingdom that is eternal, and our hope is there. And we need to put our hope in Him who is sovereign over the whole thing, and has a kingdom that is being built and is coming, and invest in that kingdom.
There you go. Terrific. Thank you for that encouraging word, Josh. Just enough time to remind you that as we're closing in on the end of the month, we're closing in on our current offer, which is a great guide to the Advent season. It's the Advent Journey of Hope, Waiting Here for You by Louis Giglio. Swing by our website, godcenteredlife.org. We'll get you more details. You have an opportunity to partner with us as well. Next time we get together, saved by confusion.
while there is certainly acting in correction and judgment in this passage, there is a gracious tinge to that correction. I mean, think about it. This is how they were trying to get to heaven. They're not going to get there that way, are they?
An interesting perspective on the Tower of Babel when we get together next time. GodCenteredLife.org. Resources for you, and this is your invitation to join us here at the God-Centered Life with Josh Moody.